London is passionate. We see as we watch the city move towards a general election of July 2024, London's passions on full display lately, be it the recent Pride in London event, all colour and laughter and noise, or be it the more recent agony of football fans sat glumly around pub TV screens until the last-minute goals lift their mood in an explosion of joy, albeit the city's well-established political fervour on all things electional. London is the home of passionate people. But not all passion is good. Sometimes we have to accept the passions of London can be dark indeed. Hate can find root in London, and from its umbral seething can emerge events that stain the city's history throughout the years. Between 1275 and 1280, there was one such event, organised by royal authorities, to be sure, but relished and enjoyed by the locals. A pogrom takes place, but one that was sanctioned and justified by the crown. And it was a pogrom not done at the hands of a rampaging mob, but was much more deadly, as it took place all legal-like, at the hands of London's courts. This is the story of that event and the events that were going on around it, the 5 years of the latter half of the 1270s, as the city rebuilt new structures moving forward. This was a London with a new mayor, a new king, and a new sense of purpose, and also some very old hatred, from which sprang terrible deeds indeed. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city in regular weekly chunks. We have reached chapter 103 of the tale, where London moved forward, redeveloped some old historic sites, dealt with the confusing miasma of day-to-day life, saw a new powerful mayor take office, and from the shadows, something evil emerged, and hundreds of its residents are going to die. Welcome, then, to From the Darkness of Hate. The early years of Edward I's rule as King of England went remarkably smoothly. What helped was that he was out of the country when he took the throne. That wild adventure of his on the crusade in the Middle East had actually worked to his benefit. The idea that absence makes the heart grow fonder seems to have been true in his case. Prince Edward, when he left the country, was the subject of biting satirical poems. He was a man known for his murderous temper and vicious temperament. But now he was returning a hero, a champion of Christendom, his sins forgiven, if not forgotten. And in his absence, no one had done anything dumb or especially corrupt. So he could return, look glorious, and it appeared that everyone genuinely saw this moment as a fresh start. He had other factors helping him. He was a highly impressive man in physical terms to look at. He stood head and shoulders above ordinary men. His long arms gave him an advantage as a swordsman. His long legs gave him an advantage as a horseman. While he was young, he was vibrant looking. His curly hair was blonde, and as he grew older, it grew darker, and by his old age, it would turn magnificent white. He had inherited a drooping left eyelid from his father, but was said to be handsome enough. He had a lisp, but was considered a good enough public speaker, a decent one anyway. He was an active and energetic human being, and even as an old man, he could mount a horse easily, and he retained good eyesight into his later years. Edward didn't inherit his father's taste for ostentatious and regal clothing. His majesty he possessed inwardly, in how he acted and how he spoke. As we know, he possessed a violent and explosive temper, a trait he inherited from his Plantagenet ancestors. We know that he once assaulted a squire with a stick, for no other reason than the young man had annoyed him somehow, and the king admitted his guilt by compensating him generously for the unprovoked attack. We know Edward liked to play chess, and we know that he gambled at games of chess, and that we know he lost quite a few times at games of chess, at least when he was younger. Household records suggest as he grew older, the losses to chess simply ceased appearing. So either he got better at it, or he just stopped playing it, or folks stopped beating him because, you know, he was a king with a temper. Mostly, however, Edward loved falconry. That was his jam. But he engaged in all types of hunting. He was big, bold, energetic. King Edward Longshanks. He represented a new start for London, new foundations of a new order. London, during these 5 years or so, goes through a period of transition and building, consolidation and regrouping. An example of the type of rebuilding, the type of new foundations being laid in the country, would be in some of the reforms King Edward introduced. Please note, he never introduced reforms because he was a reformer per se, but more, he was inheriting a government his father had allowed to do its own thing for over two generations. Things were out of date. Things needed reform. Amidst the plethora of things King Edward had to deal with, and there were scores of issues, financial considerations were a crucial one. Ever since the anarchy, England had been in a precarious financial state. Foreign merchants had exploited this weakness, and the English crown was, compared to the wealth of the French, a very poor nation indeed. The king's debts from his recent crusade were immense, and he owed a bunch of Italian moneylenders and bankers some serious amounts of cash. What was needed was a simple means of repayment. Steps could be taken, however. The massive ongoing embargo of Flemish wool, both importing and exporting, had actually seen many violations of this embargo take place, and the crown was able to profit considerably from clamping down on these. The Riccardi family of Italians were employed to collect some £13,300 worth of fines from foreign and English embargo breakers, and with a rate of payments being settled at about 10 shillings per individual sack of wool, the profitability of the operation probably contributed to the government's plan to introduce a system of permanent customs tithes and duties on the export of wool, which was probably debated at the Parliament which met in April 1275. So, new problems lead to new ideas, which lead to new rules. And you saw this reflected in London. In 1276, there are records of the first two customs houses on the Thames, one belonging to the City of London, and the other to the Crown. The latter, the more important of the two, is first recorded to the east of the present site in Lower Thames Street at Old Wool Quay. This was the same year as the appointment of the first town clerk of the City of London. This role was, and still is to a degree, the most important paid official of the Corporation of London, responsible for running and overseeing all administrative and ceremonial affairs. His appointment in this year coincides with the beginning, in 1275, of the Corporation of London's records, the most complete of any city in the world. And this building bug dealt with a London eyesore at the time. Back in chapter 83, during the years before London rebelled against King John, regular listeners may remember what we covered the story of the destruction of Baynard's Castle, one of the three great castles of London, whose building we actually covered all the way back in chapter 51, had been torn down by John's Babbacorn mercenaries, and it had, since 1213, apparently laid derelict ever since. 63 years the ruins of this once mighty castle by the Thames had just laid there. There could have been some folks building upon it, but nothing major was done on the site. It was, like many places in London in times to come, excellent land, disused and prime for redevelopment. And so it was redeveloped. Around 1275 and 1276, together with the nearby Montificio Castle, this land was granted to the Archbishop of Canterbury, so that he may provide a home for the Dominican friars already established over in Shoe Lane, just outside of the city. A huge new headquarters for the Dominicans was planned upon the site, with them gaining planning permission to demolish the city wall in its vicinity so that the buildings of these new Black Friars could be extended westwards. It was the start of the Black Friars region of the city, right here and right now, and we'll cover the actual physical building in a bit. There was more building work going on right across London, you see. On that year, an earthquake damaged many houses and churches in London, forcing repairs and rebuilding across the city. And at the same time, in a political earthquake, the zealous Edward I bowed to public hostility towards the Jews and prevented them from practicing usury, the lending of money with interest, in all future dealings. There is, of course, a lot more to this than meets the eye, and the reasons for this and its impact upon London and London's Jewish community were to be profound. While I could talk for a very long time about King Edward's hostility towards England's Jews, the 1275 Statute of Jewry, to give the law its name at the time, was Edward's ham-fisted attempt to try and move England's Jews away from money lending and towards practicing normal, legitimate trade. This new law forbade any new loans from any Jewish moneyer to take place, and also said that any existing loans owed to Jewish moneylenders were to have no new interest gained upon them after October 1275. The statute also included new rules on the punishment of Christians who defaulted on their loans, and said that no Jew could make a permanent grant of any house or rent or tenement he owed without royal permission, and nor could he even acquit any Christian of any debt without the king's consent. Other parts of the statute were more conventional and copied previous Jewish laws. For example, every Jew from the age of 7, quote, shall wear a distinguishing mark on his outer garment, that is to say, in the form of 2 tablets joined, of yellow felt, of the length of 6 inches and of the breadth of 3 inches, unquote. All Jews, male and female, over the age of 12 were to pay the king an annual tax at Easter of 3 pence. These rules, as I said, were just extensions of existing ones and were based firmly on the principle that each Jew in the kingdom was the king's serf or bondman. And on this basis, the statute made clear, the Jews would continue to receive their royal protection. However, the king felt that things could not continue as they had in the past. This was the law where King Edward demanded that the Jews of England would henceforth, quote, live by lawful trade and by their labour, unquote. In other words, they could become normal merchants instead of having to resort to being moneylenders. It was never really going to work, as the Jewish community could never be merchants on an equal scale with their English neighbours. Jews were still compelled to live only in certain places, thus their ability to trade freely and at their own discretion was highly curtailed. Added to this, the law failed to take into account the incredible amounts of bigotry and prejudice of Christian society towards the Jews. The Jewish community in London had been seen by Londoners in a certain light, and to now suggest they could be seen in another light would be insane. From the records at the time, we know London's Jewish community had long been aware of the dangers they faced from the bigotry of their neighbours around them. And there's a moment from recent London history that actually stands out for me. Back in chapter 99, when I described the rebellion of Gilbert de Clare and of how London stood up against King Henry III and besieged the papal legate Ottoboni within the Tower of London, there are actually records of how London's Jewish community, having seen what happens when their neighbours rebel against the king, had decided to sensibly flee to the Tower of London for their protection. and the papal legate, Otto Boni, had actually demanded that the able-bodied Jewish members of the London community had to defend a section of the wall of the Tower of London from attacks from their neighbours. It is said they did so bravely and desperately. They did not do this because they agreed with the papal legate or opposed the Earl of Gloucester. They did this because the reality was London's Jewish community lived surrounded by neighbours who just wanted to kill them dead for just being Jews. And to ask Londoners to now trade normally with the Jewish residents as standard merchants, that was unrealistic. The rules of 1275, this new stature, was a complete failure. Those Jews who were rich enough and were involved in money lending could simply carry on, but now much more clandestinely. But those who could not now faced a very stark choice. They could convert to Christianity, they could give in to crime, or they could starve. The Jews of London and England did not take this lying down, and several historians have tried to highlight the great enterprise and wit used by London's Jews in trying to cope with the pressures this new statute had placed upon them. But the practical reality was the result of this law was that it plunged London's Jewish community into a dire financial situation. While it may not have reduced them to starvation, these laws crippled London's Jews and England's Jews financially. And how can we say that for certainty? Well, follow the money. Edward I would continue to demand and get serious fines from England's Jewish communities for their own protection throughout this period. And between the years 1275 and until the year 1290, if you added roughly everything he raised from them this way, it came to the princely sum of about £10,000, give or take. Over a similar time period, earlier in the 13th century, before these laws were passed, Edward's father, Henry III, had raised about £66,000 from England's Jewish community, a huge drop-off. All of which suggests that going forward from now on, London's Jewish community was in steep financial decline, and things were about to get a lot worse. Meanwhile, London's internal politics seems to have calmed down somewhat, with Mayor Henry de Willis replaced by Gregory de Ruxale, who was made mayor in 1274, without any huge political rows or arguments taking place. Gregory de Ruxale was to be a significant mayor of the city. Originally from Kent, he had made his fortune in the wool trade before going on to deal in raw bullion as a goldsmith. Back in 1263, then in 1265, and then in 1270, he had served as one of London's two sheriffs. And then starting in 1274, he was made mayor, a title he was to hold 8 times. Gregory was a true royalist to King Edward I. By 1276, he was made the King's Chamberlain, a position he held until 1278, and he became one of the wardens of the Royal Mint around 1279 until his death in 1292, but more on that later. We still commemorate Mayor Gregory to this day. The site of his house, which is located near Lombard Street, near where the Church of St. Mary Woolnoth now stands, had a blue plaque placed upon it. Gregory de Ruxale was to be the real political power in London all through the latter part of the 1270s. His time in office, at first, saw none of the great political upheavals that had so rocked the city over the last few decades. Rather, Mayor Gregory's term was one focused on the more mundane aspects of things, it seemed. In 1274, one of the canons of St. Paul's Cathedral, a man called Adam de Beck, was murdered, which had caused a huge scandal. But earlier that year, the city had been shocked to witness some kind of mass breakout from Newgate Jail. By the next year, the only significant news story from London seems to have been the horror of a career of a man called Michael Thovey the Younger, who seems to have carried out a series of robberies and murders across the city before being brought to justice and hanged. Other cases that appear in London's court during Mayor Gilbert's time reflect the ongoing day-to-day problems of a large medieval city. We read of a man called Gilbert who was drunk at midday and then fell off the edge of London Bridge and was drowned in the Thames. And then there's the case of a man called Henry Lanfaire. See, a robber had claimed sanctuary in the church of St. Mary Steyning, and Henry Lanfaire had been appointed as one of the guards stationed to make sure the thief remained inside and didn't come out. It looks like the thief had tried to escape, or that Henry Lanfaire had decided to go in to fetch him because an altercation broke out and the parish priest killed this Henry. By the time we get to 1276, Mayor Gregory was in charge when a large citywide investigation was conducted to discover and take down coin clippers in the city. However, quote, only three persons were condemned, one man and two women, unquote. Now, there was a reason coin clipping was a thing. The last batch of English coins had been minted and distributed about four decades earlier. Henry III had never been fussed about reissuing new coins after the last full recoinage of English currency back in 1247. And the coins of the realm had deteriorated to such an extent that one chronicler claimed that they weighed only half of what they should, with the result that foreign merchants saw little point in coming to England to trade. Added to that, certain illegal practices had begun. The first was coin clipping, and to explain to those who wonder what it meant, you took a silver coin and then you shaved a little bit off the edge of it. You do this to enough coins and you eventually have enough shavings to melt and make a new coin, which you can stamp with a fake coin die. Ta-da! Free money. You could also just straight up make a counterfeit coin. You dip a coin made in base metal in silver, shaved off existing coins, and just pass that off. These criminal acts were epidemic and endemic across the country. And in 1276, we see London, as part of a national concern about such things, seek to find the people responsible for this ongoing criminal activity. Given it'd been going on for so long and was very widespread, the precise choice of language, only three persons were condemned, suggests that it was probably felt to be too big an issue to ever hope to catch many for it. Still, the impact of all this debasement of English coins, which were now old, smaller and shaved probably repeatedly, was to carry on. But the king in 1276 was probably thinking of other things, as Edward, King of England, was marching to war, and our records of London clearly say, quote, the king went into Wales with his forces, and the city of London sent him 100 arbalesters, unquote. Arbalesters were a type of crossbowman. The arbalest was a new class of crossbow that had found favour over in Europe and whose popularity was spreading. These were very large, very heavy wooden and metal crossbows. You couldn't pull the string back by hand. You needed to carefully winch it back, so great was its tension. And the bolts upon it were generally assumed to be armor-piercing. Now, these 100 specialist crossbowmen sent by London to serve the king could well have been local men who could afford such weapons and had practiced and trained up on them. Or they could have simply been mercenaries, skilled European specialists, paid for by London to go serve the king. Personally, I think it's the latter. And why? Well, a couple of reasons. One is a small entry in the Annals of London a year later that says, quote, the mayor received the sheriffs in the Guildhall by the king's command to spare them having to go into Wales, unquote. So it does seem to me that London was keeping everything to do with London within London, and that London hired in some foreign specialists. And maybe there's a hint that they did more than just hiring in foreign crossbowmen. There is an entry in a document called the French Chronicle of London that says in 1278, quote, three engines were made at the Tower, unquote. Now, by engines, they mean war machines, siege engines. And the traditional image we have in the 13th century is of mighty trebuchets ready to cast their rocks upon enemy fortifications. But it could have been that while the war was being waged in Wales, there in the Tower of London, some kind of giant ballista was being made, basically a larger version of the large arbalest, designed to fire giant bolts at the enemy. Alas, I do not know for sure and cannot say, but I include the telling of this as it evokes a city while war is going on, ready to supply the crown with specialist units and expertise, if not from themselves, and paid from the finest mercenaries to be found in Europe. By 1277, the first part of the king's war in Wales ended with him delivering a successful blow upon the Welsh. But we read that by 1278, with Mayor Gregory still in charge, that, quote, "The King of Scotland came to London to the King's Parliament from year to year, and had, as his mansion, most befitting his sojourn, the abode of the Earl of Lancaster, which is called Survey, without the bar of the New Temple," unquote. So London saw the King of Scotland staying in the building we today know as the Savoy, the former resident of the King's in-laws, the Savoyard family, now granted to the Earl of Lancaster, but used as a place to stay for noble visitors, in this case, King Alexander III of Scotland. King Alexander was coming to London to swear homage to Edward for his English possessions. The same way the English king would have to go to France to swear homage for his possessions in France, so the Scottish king had to do the same with the English king. Alexander's time in London I could find very little detail about, but it is interesting that he was using the Savoy as his base. But around now, over London, a dark cloud began to emerge. That investigation into coin clipping that had found such a small bunch of offenders was ongoing. And we read of a case related to it in early 1278. That January, a London Jew, Mansur son of Aaron, had been arrested, suspected of coin clipping, but had been cleared. It transpired that a portion of a clipped coin, with the forceps employed in clipping it, had been tied up in a cloth and had been maliciously thrown on top of his house in the city and found there, and had been arrested because of it. However, they were soon discovered they weren't his, and it had been a malicious setup, and Mansur, son of Aaron, was released. But we can see the link between coin clipping and popular feelings of anti-Semitic thought, and these were now rekindling the allegations of widespread coin clipping. We read that round about November the 11th of 1278, quote, "All the Jews of England were seized by reason of the coin, which was vilely clipped and falsified," unquote. The great coin clipping saga had begun, and London was about to witness another pogrom. This one was going to be overseen and done by the authorities. Now, while some records, including the ones I just quoted, said that the authorities had arrested all the Jews in England, it wasn't that many, but the numbers were staggeringly high. Evidence shows that no less than 600 Jews were imprisoned in the Tower of London for 140 days between 1278 and 1279. And it's been suggested that these may have been the heads of all the English Jewish households. After the arrest by December 13th of that year, quote, "All the goldsmiths of London, and all those of the exchange, and many of the good folks in the towns were seized by reason of the purchase of bullion and the exchange of large coin for small, for which they had been indicted by the wards. On the Monday next after, the justicars sat at the Guildhall for delivery thereon, namely Sir Stephen de Pevenskesty, Sir Walter de Halen, and Sir John de Cobham," unquote. So this rounding up of suspects in respects to large-scale coin clipping and currency fraud didn't just involve Jews. It, as it said, it had gone after all the goldsmiths and those of the exchange and many of the good folks in the town. They went after the oligarchs. But, well, not everybody got the same kinds of punishment. See, the punishments meted out for those who were found guilty of this kind of crime were harsh and swift. Brutal punishments for offences against coinage were not new. As far back as 1124, King Henry I had ordered that all moneyers in England should have their right hands cut off after he'd received complaints from his mercenaries about the quality of coins which they were being paid. However, the number of those punished in 1278 and 1279 was very large, and those punished severely was incredibly large, and they were almost exclusively all Jewish. One chronicler claimed at the time that 280 Jewish men and women were executed in London alone, and a great many more in other cities. A London chronicler claimed that 293 Jews were hung in the city, while the chronicler of the Abbey of Bury St. Edmunds claimed that only 267 Jews suffered this fate in the capital. Other writers at the time are less specific, but they all agree that an incredibly large number of Jews were executed for offences against the coinage at this time. For the longest time, when you read historical research on this, it does seem to be that British historians had a real difficulty in accepting these figures, despite their exactness. Many felt we should not take them seriously, that they were an example of medieval hyperbole. However, recent research has shown that they are almost certainly credible numbers. Shortly after the arrests, for example, the sheriffs of London and Middlesex received payment for, quote, doing justice on 269 Jews, unquote. Doing justice is a euphemism for executing. It's also worth noting that while some records say that only three Christians were executed for the same crime at the same time, the sheriffs of London went on to receive financial allowance for hanging 29 Christians around the same time. Now, there is no reason to think that the Jews were so much more heavily involved in debasing the coinage than the Christians who'd been arrested alongside them. Indeed, the bulk of the evidence so far uncovered, which deals with offences against the coinage at this time, concerns almost overwhelmingly cases involving Christians. But you see, Christians, most of them, were able to pay fines to escape more serious punishment, whilst the proportion of accused Jews who were able to do this was staggeringly small. It is clear that religious prejudice was a crucial factor when it came to deciding what people's punishments should be. And this is why over 250 Jews were executed in London. The early months of 1279 must therefore have been a time of incredible fear and anxiety for the Jews of the city. And it has to be taken on board that the government's punitive attitude towards the Jews encouraged others to further persecute them in less official ways. For example, by late spring of 1279, the government seems to have been aware that their anti-Jewish policy was slipping out of control. On the 7th of May, an order went out bringing this whole coin-clipping pogrom to an end. And it was said that no Jew would be charged with any new offences against the coinage, and that if those already in jail made a payment to the king, they could be released from prison. This act of apparent royal mercy might suggest that Edward and his ministers had become genuinely concerned for the welfare of the Jews by the middle of 1279. Also, it could be that he decided there was no more money to be gained. See, over those first few months, Edward had gathered over £11,000 from the sale of goods and property from London's and England's Jewish community. And basically, at this point, any clemency would cost him little, as the substantive had already been seized. However, there may have been another reason for the ending of the pogrom, and that suggests a darker reason for the whole damn episode. Evidence found by historian Paul Brand suggests that before the start of this coin-clipping inquiry, in order to ensure convictions against all the coin-clippers and other abusers of coinage, the government had sent agents in secret around the country buying up silver which had been made from melted down clippings. One of these undercover operatives was a converted Jew, Henry of Winchester. He'd been regularly and profitably employed in royal service, at least from the early 1250s. And he probably would have been able to collect evidence, not just from Christians, but from Jewish communities without arousing too much suspicion. So it could be that all those Jews arrested and imprisoned in 1278 and 79 may well have been victims of a very well organized sting operation instigated by the crown itself. Simply put, that meant the government of Edward I knew before January 1279, when the inquiry into coin clipping was formally begun, the identities of all those who they wanted to arrest, because men like Henry of Winchester and others had already gathered up the evidence against them. Perhaps this is why there were already 600 Jews in the Tower by the end of 1278, and also why the coin clipping campaign was halted in May 1279. If the original trials had been conducted on the basis of information collected by the government's agents, there might have indeed have a good reason to suppose that any further accusation was pointless now. Now, I'm going to say it would be naive to think that all those Jews who were found guilty and punished during those couple of years were in fact innocent of the charges brought against them. Members of the Jewish community had been heavily involved in coin clipping and the activities associated with it. But the proportion of Jews involved in such criminality was identical to the proportion of Christians within the general population also involved in such criminality. It's just that one community was disproportionately executed for these deeds compared to the other. Above all, it is likely that many innocent Jews did suffer unjustly as a result of the activities of men like Henry of Winchester, and by extension, by the will and direction of King Edward I. He had much to gain financially from the confiscations and fines imposed on the convicted Jews, and it seems he was personally involved in appointing at least some of those who inquired into the coin-clipping allegations. The overall sting operation was directed by the Crown for the benefit of the Crown. And while the standard debate would be to say that his motivation was simply anti-Semitism and he hated the Jews, it could also be that he had an urging need to issue new coinage, and that, having decided to go for a recoinage by 1271, he realised this was a costly business involving the recruitment of new moneyers, the manufacture of new coin dies, the purchasing of equipment and the refurbishment of old buildings. The £11,000 or so that Edward recovered from those Jews found guilty of coin offences would have proved very useful. But we can't ignore the anti-Jewish dimension to the events of these years. I mean, by 1280, we have orders coming out from the government stating that royal officials should be seeking to induce Jews to convert to Christianity. And just 4 months later, Edward issued new regulations for the administration of the Domus Conversum in London, whose origin we discovered in a previous chapter. The principle in the Domus that of all the goods of a converted Jew were seized by the crown was actually relaxed. Henceforth, converts would be permitted to keep half the value of their goods. These new regulations were issued, the king asserted, because he believed, quote, that the conversion of Jewish depravity to the Catholic faith would specially be to the increase of faith and worship of the name of Christ. And at the same time, the king also ordered that a priest should be appointed to oversee and manage the Domus. He should be assisted by a chaplain, preferably himself a convert, unquote. Taken together, the events of the 1270s display the ambivalent nature of Edward's approach towards the Jews. On the one hand, the king was prepared to countenance or turn a blind eye to the brutality and violence of 1278 and 79. Yet on the other, his desire peaceably to convert Jews to Christianity and turn them away from usury towards less sinful trading activities seems to have been quite genuine and heartfelt, even if they are horrendously bigoted. Added to this, the church itself also had significant agency in this matter, and the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Henry Peacham, we see was a constant spur towards curtailing the lives of London's Jews. Peacham was also a Franciscan, and the members of this order, as well as their fellow mendicants, the Dominicans, with their emphasis on preaching, conversion and poverty, had always taken a particular interest in the Jews and in their beliefs and in their practices. In London, the Jewish residents were ordered to attend sermons weekly by the Dominicans of the city in the hope that they would convert. And as early as September 1272, so only a month after Edward had returned to England from his crusade, an order was issued for the closure of the Jews' principal London synagogue on the east side of Cole Church Lane, following a request from the neighbouring community of friars. The Jews, they claimed, were making such a noise during their worship that the friars could not carry out their own services properly. Having been given royal consent to build a new synagogue, the Jews were forced to abandon their Cole Church Lane site. By the early 1280s, a new location on the south side of Kate Street had been found, but Archbishop Beauchamp was unhappy when he heard about the Jews' building plans. His initial attempt was to try and stop the construction of the new synagogue completely, and he wrote to the then Bishop of London, Richard Gravesend, in July 1281, ordering him to intervene. Peckham's efforts were unsuccessful, but this did not prevent him from writing to Gravesend again in August of the following year, this time ordering him to shut down all the private synagogues he had heard were being used in London. He eventually conceded, however, in a third letter, that the Jews could, well, they could have a new communal synagogue, quote, as long as it was small, unquote. So it wasn't just the crown who was after London's Jews. It was also the impact of the growing influence of the Dominicans in the city. And by 1278, while all this is going on, those Dominicans properly started work on their new site of Blackfriars. Quote, the Friars Preachers of London began the foundation of their new church at Castle Baynard, unquote. And we also read that, quote, in this year the exchange was made at the Tower of London of new money, sterling, halfpenny and farthing, and Gregory de Rooksale was made master of the exchange throughout all England, unquote. And yeah, as I mentioned many times in the past, London's association with the making the coins of the realm carried on, and the principal mint of London was moved to the security of the Tower of London in 1278 from the old change near Cheapside. And at the same time, look who's appointed the master moneyer for the whole realm. None other than the Mayor of London, Gregory de Rooksale. Mayor Gregory, now looking glorious with his new title and given his new responsibility, would then stand down as Mayor of London. And his replacement was none other than Henry de Wallace, the Welsh mine merchant, returned to being mayor as the city's rich oligarchs continued to hold power, but now with added smooth transitions of mayoral candidates. Thus, very smoothly, we enter the 1280s and London in that decade. War with the Welsh raged, but London was carrying on, lively and passionate, and stained with the blood of over 600 Jews murdered by the state. Worse was to come for London's Jews. Within a decade, every single one of them was to be expelled. And that begs the question, if in the darkness of hate, London could vent its more ugly passions upon the Jews, and you simply took the Jews away, upon whom would London seek to vent its dark passions upon in the future? Well, I'll leave that one for a future episode. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next week for chapter 104 in the story of London. This is Saul, thanking everybody for their continued support, lovely reviews, wonderful donations that have kept us going, and the feeling that, you know, people are listening to it and enjoying it. Thanks so much. See you next week. Bye.